Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to Real Talk JavaScript. This is the episode you've been waiting for on GraphQL, Ward Bell's favorite topic. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fabulous. And yes, you just say the word graph and QL, and I just start salivating like a mad dog. Maybe that's foaming like a mad dog. But we're not alone. We've got our other esteemed colleague, Dan Wallin.
Esteemed, yes.
Are you esteemed or are you just steamed because you're living in
steamed.
Arizona?
Probably steamed right now. Yeah, I think we were 110 yesterday. That's Fahrenheit for those on Celsius. But that'd be like, what would be 110 Celsius would be like lava temperature or something, I guess. I don't know.
I'm guessing 36, 34?
Yeah.
I don't know. But you know,
I'm saying if it was 110 Celsius.
Yeah, 110 Celsius, we'd be rough.
A little rough, but yeah, doing good here.
Well, we don't use that system in America because that's commie madness. We didn't go metric. We didn't go metric, and we didn't pick up Celsius because that's just disturbing American bags.
Yeah, why would we want to actually do what the rest of the world is doing, you know?
Nope.
Like,
the U.S. were actually given the opportunity to go metric. As the first country in the world. So, obviously it came from France, but they offered it to the US and the US said no out of loyalty to the UK. They wanted to...
Really?
Absolutely. They wanted to keep that relationship strong. And so they chose to keep feet and inches and all of that.
I did not know that part of history.
I did not know that. And then you guys snuck out the back door and went metric on us.
Well, you know,
left us holding the imperial bag.
Secretly, we still use imperial in the UK, but we're not allowed to. So it's
hush, hush, huh?
Absolutely.
Oh my! So some of you may remember we've had Daniel Rowe on as one of our guests in the past. That was Daniel Rowe speaking there. And for those of you who may not be familiar with Daniel, let me tell you a little bit about him. Daniel is starting a company that helps businesses supporting working parents. He's always loved technology, but he's also studied law, founded a message consultancy, and taught Greek. And he was on our show a couple months ago, not too long ago, talking about Nuxt and the server-side rendering and a bunch of other features of that platform. And we were originally going to talk about GraphQL and Nuxt, but we got so deep into Nuxt that we said, you know what? Let's give GraphQL its own show. And Daniel was kind enough to come back on. So thanks for coming back, Daniel.
It's a pleasure to be back.
We're actually going to talk about Greek today.
It's Greek QL. There
Greek
you go.
QL.
It's using the Omega language.
I am trying to remember whether, because it wasn't ancient Greek, was it? Was it ancient Greek that you did?
You're absolutely right. I taught Corner. The common tongue around sort of the time of the New Testament.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. Which we're all looking forward to getting back to that. Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
How did you get into that? Just real quick before we get a little more technical here.
Well, on my career journey from law, which is what I studied first, to technology, which is where I am now. I also studied theology, and I was even a church minister here in England, or a vicar, as we call it.
Yeah, clearly somebody who didn't know what the heck he wanted to do in life, and his parents were very upset with him, and.
So today we're going to be getting into the drama of my life story, which
yes, much more interesting than
John. He introduced GraphQL, but that wasn't our motivation at all.
No,
Daniel, you know,
no. We want to know how the heck Daniel took that circuitous route into down this road of perdition.
Anyway. So tell us, what is GraphQL really? I mean, we all talk about it. We hear about it all the time, talking about you should be using GraphQL, Vue, React, Angular, whatever, with all of your web apps, with Jamstack, to get our data. But I've got HTTP. Why do I need GraphQL, and what is it?
So at its most basic, GraphQL is just a way of structuring queries, structuring the getting data and putting data back to a server. And it just takes place over HTTP. So you can even, if you're curious and you have a GraphQL endpoint, you can just fire a string at that endpoint. And as long as it's correct GraphQL, you'll get the right kind of response back. So you can write your own client pretty easily. But it's a way of taking of specifying what shape of data you want to receive back from the server, for example, and doing that in a really strongly typed way. So if normally you would have a user's endpoint on your REST API, and you're going to get back a list of your users, and each of those users might have a name and an email address. You'd expect that in your front end. Actually, let me just rewind a bit. I guess GraphQL, and the reason we're interested in it, I'm interested in it from my point of view, is that it's a way of talking about this. It's a way of getting data from a back end to a front end. So I might write my JavaScript front end, and I need data to populate that and make it dynamic and interesting. And I need to get that data from somewhere else. And that back end might be under my control. It might not be. And if I want data for my front end, I'm really relying on that data having a certain kind of shape, having certain kind of properties. So if I'm looking at users, I might rely on the fact that every user is going to have an email address and maybe an ID or something like that. In our particular case, so we're building an app for to help working parents, or help support working parents. We control the front end, we control the back end. But as you start building features into the back end, suddenly your user object starts getting populated with more information, or the shape of information might change slightly. So maybe you used to have a field called company, and your user had a company that was just a string. But you've decided that company is a bit more complicated now, and maybe your company has a company ID as well as a name, and over time it changes. But if your front-end code is assuming that company is just going to be a string, you might have a lot of difficulty. So that's a long way to say that GraphQL solves that problem, and a lot of others.
So in a nutshell, you're kind of saying, if I was building a React app or Angular or some other front-end type of app, I have a little more control, I guess, over what I can request. So if company does change?
Absolutely. So it shifts the balance of power from the back end to the front end a little bit. And so front end engineers like it for that reason. So previously, I guess the front end engineer was entirely at the mercy of the back end. The shape of the API, the back end decided what it was going to send, and the front end engineer needed to deal with it. So you needed to parse it, make sure that it was correct, make sure that it had the right kind of shape, make sure that it had the properties you were expecting. You had to be very, very careful with the data you had coming in. So if you're anything like me, then I mostly use TypeScript within the applications I write, and one of the reasons I do that is that I want to make sure that when I'm passing values around in my code, I'm not making assumptions that are wrong about that data. So that I say, well, this thing should be a string, so I'm going to pass it to a function that's expecting a string, and I'm not going to pass it to something that thinks it's an object. And that's great as long as you're entirely in control of the code, because if you're just passing internal values around, you're fine. But the moment you start bringing in uncontrolled data, just JSON that you've passed from some API, you have no idea what that is. You might make assumptions, or you might correctly think that it's shaped one way as of the time of you're writing the code, but it might change. And that can cause a lot of problems, and in some cases, problems that are really difficult to debug when you're in a production environment.
You gave me an idea for a new API. I'm going to call it the Deal With It API. It's not RESTful or anything. It's just Deal With It, Ward.
Yeah, I'm going to try and deal with it. So Daniel, that sounded a little magical. I want to put some pressure on that, but I want to back up a little bit because there is a whole versioning aspect to data that comes over, but we'll get back to that. But normally with HTTP, I just hit an endpoint and I get some stuff back and it's what I expect or I throw up, right? I mean, that's kind of the normal way in which we work. But GraphQL is saying something more in terms of its capabilities. And it's got the word graph in it. So what does the word graph in GraphQL mean, first of all? Help our listeners understand that.
Now let's take a break and listen to a word from our sponsors. Hey Ward, you know, I was building an application the other day and I pulled in this really cool UI component, but it brought along a lot of dependencies with it. How do you deal with that?
I don't like that, John. It reminds me that the AG grid, which is an advanced editable data table that we use in a lot of our enterprise apps because it addresses the complex scenarios we encounter. AG grid doesn't have any dependencies at all.
Zero dependencies. Well, tell me, why is that good? Like, what is the value of having zero dependencies?
Well, it's wonderful not having to wonder if while I'm pulling that in, I'm also pulling jQuery in or Lodash or who knows what. In part because that's extra stuff coming over the wire. It's extra files that I don't know what they're all about. It means when my client security team has to evaluate this, they're evaluating AG Grid and not everything else that might be slipping in under the covers or something that we have to worry about there.
You know, it's great to see this day and age, you can have a zero dependency library that does something like complex data grid functionality. So all of you out there, do check out AG Grid at their website at ag-grid.com. And now we're coming back. And Daniel, Ward was just asking you about, which is actually a great question, which is funny coming from Ward, right? So what does graph mean from GraphQL?
So one of the great things about GraphQL is that it allows you to specify in a single query everything that you need to know from the server. Whereas you might previously have had to patch this together through a series of different REST API calls. So if you're thinking about that user again, and you want to know that user's company, on your backend, that might be stored in a couple of database tables. So you might have a companies table, you might have a users table, and then on the user, you might have we'll have a company ID. And behind the scenes in your backend app, depending on what that is, you might have an ORM, some kind of way of mapping the data from the one table so that you can access properties from related objects. So you can find out things like the company name for a given user. GraphQL allows you to make use of those kind of relationships in your query. So you could say, I want a list of users, please. And actually, the only thing I care about is their name because we're not going to do anything with them. We're just going to display them in a list. And I also want the company name. And you can put that all in the single query. And what you get back is this beautifully simple list of users, but all you have is that username and the company name. So you just get the data you need.
Let me take this back a little bit and see if I've got you right. So the graph part means that I can get an object graph, which is right. Is that
exactly?
So if I had companies and the companies had orders and orders had order details and all that other stuff, and if I wanted. And all that stuff could be just, you know, if it was normalized SQL, it would be all sitting in different tables. But as a consumer, I just want the root company and this tree of interesting stuff. And GraphQL could allow me to assemble that tree and not worry about doing all the joining myself. I just sort of specify in GraphQL language, I want this graph of an object. Is that what you were saying, kind of?
That's exactly right. So when you say graph, I think relationship. I think you're drawing lines between things and saying these are connected in some way.
Yeah, and graph is a better word than relationship QL, right?
Well,
that'd probably be a dating site or something.
Well, because we do, but we talk about these as object graphs all the time, and they have nodes in them, which are these entities that are, you don't know how they're stored. They could be stored anywhere, but as a consumer of the entity graph, I'm expecting a little structure. Or the thing that you had been talking about earlier, Daniel, is something that we would technically call a projection, in which you take, you were saying, I want the user, I want one property from the user and one property for the company, and I just want you to smush those together into this object that I call user company, and voila. And instead of having a back-end developer write that endpoint for me, you're saying that with GraphQL, I can write it myself as a client. I get to specify my shape, my graph on the client. Is that kind of what you're going for?
Absolutely. And it's such a feeling of power, because even if you are controlling the back end as well as the front end, there's always a feeling of you don't want to create too many endpoints, right? You want to have your user's endpoint, but you don't want to have your users with only username endpoint and your users with usernames and company names endpoint. So what you end up doing is moving all of that work into the client. So you get all the users and then you filter them or you map them or you, and how you get that data throughout your app starts getting complicated. And then particularly if you also want to normalize it so that you are doing lookups on the IDs of I mean, of course, you can do it in different ways, but typically it's more memory efficient to, if you're working with a REST API, rather than storing all of the relationships within, so if you have your users array, rather than storing within that array all of your companies as well within each user, you just want a relationship. And so you might end up pulling in a JavaScript ORM it ends up being really complicated and actually putting a lot of the work in the end user's browser, which is probably not the best way of doing it. I mean, if you can get the server to do it in the first place, that feels like a much more natural place for it to live. I guess one of the things I also like, and which you alluded to, Ward, as well, is that if you're dealing with a REST API, it feels good because it often mirrors the shape of the backend data. So you have a user's table and you have a user's endpoint and you have a company's table and you have a company's endpoint. But really, the front end shouldn't need to know the structure of the data in the backend, how it works. What the front end developer needs to know is just how the data, what the relationships are between the different entities and how they and what kind of information they need to display.
So we've been down this road before. I'm gonna push back a little, and just to folks know, I do like GraphQL. But to push back a little, when I first heard about this, one of the things that threw me off a little, with a little cautionary in the wind here, is it is very powerful. You're giving your client all this power to query whatever you want. Is that a good thing, though? What if I don't want the client to be able to have access to everything? What if I want the client to have access to just certain things? What if I want the client to have access based upon authorization roles or authentication in the app? Can you talk a little about that, Daniel?
So GraphQL supports all of that. So you don't expose absolutely everything. It's not just that you're effectively giving your front end access to every data, every row in every table, with no kind of authorization.
Give me the whole database. Let's go. Bring it all to the client.
See, we had this before back in the... Did you ever do .NET, Daniel?
No, I never did.
You somehow skipped a brilliant chapter in the history of computing. Anyway, there was something called
some people
OData.
Would say that chapter is still going on, by the way, Ward.
No, it's all fascinating.
No.
That was the first thing I thought, John.
You know, half our audience is like, what?
Big announcement today on Real Talk JavaScript.
No, but that's it. .NET, passe, move on. No, there was a thing called OData, which had many of the same goals that you're describing. And before there was OData, there was DevForce, which is something that we wrote at IdeaBlade. So I know a thing or two about this kind of thing. And one of the criticisms is just where John is coming from. And we had the word for it was, as soon as you do this, you're letting somebody party on your database. I always loved that.
That's a cool term.
Let's party like on the database. I can do it. Woo! It's all mine.
Wait, I just saw that on GraphQL's homepage. Party on your, no, I'm kidding.
Party on. So how, Daniel, and that was really one of the biting criticisms of our approach. And so how do you, is it easy to keep somebody from partying on the database?
So we, so you can talk about the cost of a query in GraphQL and calculate how much time is going to be required to run that query. And you can actually set budgets for front-end clients so that they're limited in what they can ask the server to do, because it is possible to come up with queries that could actually take a great deal of server resources. It's also possible. It's and the moment you move to a GraphQL approach, so you have one endpoint. So there's just one endpoint, and all of the magic happens within the just the text that you send.
Exactly,
send
it's that. One ring to rule them all. But it's
which is that's the power of the ring, isn't it?
Yes, but it's the power of the ring. But with that power comes great. We're mixing all of our cartoon metaphors here.
But it does do that. As in, it's not a bad metaphor, because you do have this as power. But you're right. You have to start thinking about things like caching. I can't guarantee that your normal strategies for caching don't work in the same way. So, you know, if you're caching a public endpoint, public GET endpoint, let me be pretty precise, you'd expect that you can just cache that response pretty easily, because every time you hit that, until the content is updated, and you can talk about cache invalidation until the cows come home, but, you know, typically you can cache that. It's not going to change. But GraphQL, well, you certainly can't cache the GraphQL endpoint. It's not going to work. So you have to move all of your caching work into your server. Yes, it starts getting more complicated.
Well, just to be clear, so you can't cache your GraphQL endpoint because there is just one endpoint.
So and everything's coming over it.
Right. You know. So you wouldn't know what to cache or how to cache it or...
So what we did, I don't know if you can do this in GraphQL, but on the client side, what we would do is we would remember the query. And then we would decide whether we already knew the answer to that query and held that locally on the client. I don't know if GraphQL provides client-side tools that allow you to do that, so you can say, oh, yeah, I asked for that before and I don't really need it again. Is there a client-side library that helps you with that stuff?
Yes, absolutely. If you're talking from the client side, then something like, Apollo has a great set of tools that includes an Apollo client, which has some very interesting caching. So you can, not only can you just cache the results of a given query, but you can also start normalizing and merging things together. So if I ask for a list of users with only their name in one query, and I ask for a list of users but only their email address in another query, I can start to actually merge those and do something interesting with them. I haven't mentioned it yet, of course, but GraphQL isn't only one way. So you can also perform mutations, make changes to data in much the same way as you would do using a post or a put or a delete request. And so you can include that in the cache as well. So if you are deleting something, you can remove it from the cache. And if you're modifying something, you can also modify it in the cache. I've got to say, in my experience, this is not the simplest thing in the world to set up a good caching structure with Apollo, but it is possible to do.
It never is, and the writing side of this equation is always more complicated than they let on. It always was more so with data. It was great with IdeaBlade's DevForce. I just another commercial there, the strength of these things is primarily in the robust query language and the ability to sort of translate your intention into data results. It's really the query side, the QL part, right? The query language part.
Daniel, this is interesting, and I want to get deeper into some of these pieces, but what I haven't heard yet is quite how we restrict the client from getting access to certain parts of the data. Can you clarify how that works?
Well, so one of the most common patterns is to attach the data that you want to be associated with, say, the particular user, to that user. So you might query, I want to see my favorites. I want to see my saved items. And that's going to automatically protect what you get, because you're starting effectively by looking up that individual user, and then you're working with models or objects that have that are starting from that point. More generally, a GraphQL server it decides what to return to a given query based on resolvers. So it's you can in fact put your own GraphQL server even that translates the GraphQL query and then resolves it using anything, including REST queries to other APIs. So that's where your authentication and authorization logic would live. So typically, I guess what you'd do is you'd have a header, an authorization header, bearer token probably, and then your GraphQL server decides what to do with that. So what resources you can access, how it's going to resolve your query, given that that say your JavaScript script web token, given that you are coming in with a set of permissions, what is it going to allow you to do? I guess that's much the same as, in a sense, with your REST API. It's what are you allowed to see and what are you not allowed to see? Does that answer your question, or have I somehow skipped it?
It does. There's a second half to it, but I want to defer to Dan because he had a question that I think is related to this.
So Daniel, from a JavaScript developer standpoint, if I'm starting out, and let's just assume for now, and then maybe we can get into it a little bit later, that some type of GraphQL functionality is available on the server. What am I going to have to do to get started as a JavaScript developer on the client side, though? Like, walk us through, what's that process?
So there's a lot of tooling and there are a lot of libraries to help developers. Technically, you don't need them. They exist to make your life easier. You might decide to use something like Apollo Client. Apollo Client is a big library and with a lot of functionality, including the cache that we've talked about. And there are others. It would be a case of figuring out what's a good match for you. I think one of the most interesting ones that's out there at the moment is called GQLess, which is pretty cool. You don't even have to write your queries if you use GQLess. It automatically translates your accessing an object into the query that it will perform. And anyway, I think that's amazing.
Is this a query by example thing where you give it the shape of the thing that you want and it interprets it? Or what is this magic? Does it read my mind?
It's definitely magic. So so with GQLess, you install a dev tool which queries your endpoint and figures out the shape of the data that you're looking at. It then uses that to create a typed proxy that allows you to access that in now GQLess works really well with React, but it can be used on its own as well.
Looking at the page real quick, and it does use the term automagically. So
yeah,
Ward, you were on it.
Yeah. And everybody out there, we have been adding the links into all the show notes for all these awesome tidbits that Daniel's dropping. So please check out the show notes too.
So if you're using GQLess, you start by running a command. It populates the types of the object that you're going to access. And then you get auto-completion in your editor. So you type query dot, and then a drop-down list pops down. And you build your query like that. You don't need to worry so much about the query that you're generating. Because it will just figure out, oh, he was only interested in this property and that property, so we're going to create a query that just has those things in it. And it does that by setting time slices, as I recall. I'm happy to go into the details. So there's a wonderful JavaScript proxy object. Proxies are amazing. Proxies can sit between you and as a developer and the object that they are proxies for. So you can do things, fire commands, respond with different objects or different properties based on your own sweet will. they're really cool. And one of the things that they're particularly well suited for in my particular use case is the is building something that doesn't exist and then translating it into reality. So because you can use the dot syntax to access some property of an object that doesn't exist, and then the proxy translates that into something that
is this a standard JavaScript proxy that you're talking about, or something else?
I'm just talking about the standard JavaScript proxy that, gotcha, that you'd use anywhere but in IE11. But anyway, GQLess is one client, but there are lots more. I think Apollo client is a really well used one. If you're using Vue, I would recommend something like Vilas, which is really lightweight. I will drop a link to that as well in the show notes.
I've heard a lot in the last couple of months about Hasura with GraphQL. Maybe I'm saying the word wrong, but Hasura. Have you experience with that, and what do you think of that with GraphQL?
So I love Hasura. So one of the great things about, although I'm not familiar with any client that Hasura has. So if they do, then I might be I've just missed it. But Hasura, basically, as I understand it, transforms a database into a GraphQL server endpoint, and they do a lot more than that. But they mean you don't have to worry about creating your own server.
It's more that server side access, but not the client API, from what I'm gathering as well, too.
Exactly, but it is automatical as well. So you take a server with tables and a database schema, and it translates that into again a typed API. And if some of the things you get out of the box with GraphQL are you often have a playground, so you can access and build your queries, do that with auto completion, see what the type of the object that you're going to get back is. You can just do that by going to the endpoint often and just starting to type, and it makes life as a dev really easy because you're not making mistakes. There is great IDE integration as well. So again, you can just, it might look like a string, tagged template literal. But in
Daniel,
fact,
Daniel, I'm going to interrupt you for a sec, because I feel like maybe it's just, you know, this crazy world we're living in. I feel like this is one of those tools that has taken off over the last 3 or 4 years considerably. It's been around longer, but taken off considerably. And there's products coming out for the server, for the client, for managing the whole thing. For mobile, I've even seen as well. I see the cloud providers getting into it. It seems like somebody new coming into this, as Dan mentioned, you're like, how do you get started? Almost feels like we have too many options.
So
like, where would you start? If you're going to, our listeners are all going to start tomorrow, what would you recommend that they do?
So I like lightweight things. So one of the first things I would do is install a plugin in your favorite editor. So I use VS Code, this great Apollo plugin for VS Code. I would absolutely install that straight away. That's going to give you autocomplete as you type support for creating GraphQL queries, which if this is the first time you're using it, you might not understand the query language entirely, and it will be really helpful to prevent you from making any kind of mistakes. And it reflects the shape of your data at the other end. So you see what options you have, and you're able to make some good responses. There are also a lot of great resources online, by the way, just in terms of figuring out what GraphQL is and how it works, including from Hasura, who have great online resources, and Apollo GraphQL. They have some really good tutorials online as well. And I'm sure there are lots of others too, but I would definitely go to Apollo GraphQL and Hasura. They've got some good tutorials.
Yeah, it seems like Apollo is the one I see a lot of, I don't know if it's their developer relations or what it is, but they seem to get the word out really well about what GraphQL is doing. So would you think people should go to their docs and whatnot too, as far as getting started?
I would just go straight to, yeah, absolutely. Apollo is really good, and they have a full-featured ecosystem. So that's the first thing you do. You install your IDE plugin. That's going to make sure, that's going to give you lots of things out of the box. I would add as a dev dependency to my project something, the Apollo client at the very least. It's going to let you create generate TypeScript types for any queries that you create, for example. So even if that you're just running that in dev, that is going to mean that you can basically say, I'm running this query. You run a script in your dev mode, and you get automatically a file is created with the type for the query you've created, and you can just import it if you're using TypeScript. Next step is to pull in a client. So you want, I think, start off with something that's really minimal. Don't worry about cache. You'll figure out the issues that you'll need to deal with by working from the ground up. So you'll encounter, if you encounter a performance issue, you can deal with it. But I wouldn't worry about it to start with. So there are just some really minimal clients that you can use. So I'd use Vilis if you're using Vue. I'd use GQLess if you're up for something a little bit out of the box. Or you can use Apollo. Apollo has everything, and it will definitely work. There's some great integration for Vue, which again is where I'm coming from, and React as well. React is straight in the Apollo docs. And it's a very simple thing. You just install it, and you drop in some configurations. You're going to need to pass some options. There's a quick start guide, and your options are things like your endpoint, which you pop in your Apollo config.js. And if you have... If you have any kind of authentication, you might have to put in a bearer token as well, and obviously.
So this gets to leads inevitably back to the server. We keep talking server. Do I have? I need a GraphQL server, don't I? Or can I? I mean, I can't just use GraphQL against any old thing, can I? I can't point it at Amazon's public API or the Star Wars characters API or the, you know, any of that stuff, can I? Or do I need a GraphQL server, don't I?
So yes and no. I think you need a server, but you can actually run your server in your client, as in on your front end. This is not something I've done, but you can write resolver. I was talking about resolvers being the things that turn a query and decide what the data is that comes back. If you want, you can write your front end using GraphQL syntax, but run it against your Apollo client, as in run it against the client that is running in the front end, and then
so kind of like mocking it, then sort of mocking the data.
Pretty much. I mean, it's because of how GraphQL works. It is exactly the same way it works on the server. So you're taking the query and you're turning that into you're using that to come up with the kind of data that you return to it. So yes, you can create your own resolvers on the client side.
I'm essentially resolving GraphQL queries into the down and dirty under the hood HTTP calls I would need to implement them. Is that kind of, that's what my resolution, that's what my resolver is doing? It's sitting between the GraphQL language and how it actually works under the hood.
Yes, I think that's a great description of it. It's worth saying that you don't, when you start building a GraphQL app, you don't have to have the GraphQL server built yet at that point. GraphQL is particularly well suited to mocking because it so clearly specifies the data that you're getting back. So if you sit down and you write your GraphQL query, you can guarantee the type of what comes back. So you could use something like So Apollo has its own mocking capability, which again is magic. So you can do that very well. There's a great tool by Sam Selikov called Mirage, which supports GraphQL mocking. That again, Mirage runs client side, but it behaves as though it's a separate server. So I think it uses service workers. But again, it's fantastic for starting off, even if you don't have a backend yet.
So that's the way I can live the good GraphQL life, but still be dealing with a traditional server. I can simply put this translation layer on my client, and then my application will behave as if it was GraphQL, and I get that kind of support. But then when I have to get down and dirty to talk to my ancient API, I just do it through this translation layer that's made up of resolvers. Is that essentially what you're saying I could do?
You could absolutely do that. I think here's where I get personal, man.
We're here to listen to your personal story.
Well, I mean, I feel I'm here to learn a bit from you as well. So I wouldn't be wanting, I don't so love GraphQL that I would want to turn everything into GraphQL. I mean, I feel that I would want to be getting REST API. I think if I'm dealing with APIs that are REST APIs, I would probably want to access them that way. I think GraphQL, particularly, I wouldn't put it all in the client, because I think I'd lose a lot of the benefits that I have been talking about, such as moving the heavy lifting to the server. Whereas if I'm running a GraphQL client with resolvers in the end user's browser, I now have a lot more to deal with than I did before.
So right. It could be very chatty too, in a way. It wouldn't be necessarily very efficient, right? So you want to move that. So now you're back to the question of how, so I really want a GraphQL server.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you want a GraphQL server. And I think, I think you know, that's not going to be right for every web app. So I think particularly you're wanting a GraphQL server if your web app is going to have a long lifetime. So if you're building, if you're just building it, and it's not going to be, it only has a very specific use case, the backend is not going to change, and you don't have a huge number of different models to look at. You're not accessing them throughout a massive code base that might have many different ways of viewing them and many different requirements. If it's just a simple app, you really don't need to be stretching for GraphQL. GraphQL, I think, is phenomenally useful if you have a large surface area and potentially a long lifetime. But I think, you know, that's my point of view.
No, I think that fits. That's true for ORMs. That was true for OData. That's true for every one of these abstractions. If the problem is simple and the model is small, don't use an abstraction. The value of a thing like GraphQL is when you have a model of, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe 30, 50, 100 different objects that are all interrelated, and you like to connect those related objects in different ways, consume them in different ways, and you don't want to be, you know, then you start to get a big payoff to having an abstraction that can do the plumbing for you.
Let's take a quick break from a word from our sponsors.
Hey, are you building apps in React, Angular, Node, or some other framework? Well, with NX, you can build your full stack apps in a shared mono repo, integrate with modern tools, and reinforce best practices. You'll get advanced code generation and automatically configured tooling like Cypress, Jest, and Prettier that will simplify your workflow. NX also helps you simplify the relationships between applications and shared libraries to make it easier to share more code and develop more consistently across teams. And the best part is you'll build higher quality apps and spend less time on configuration. So visit nx.dev to get Narwhal's popular open source toolkit for monorepo development today.
And we're back.
Yeah, I think it's really good to bring out that you have to have a problem that's proportional to this kind of a solution, because you've described a lot of things I do have to learn to, you know, I fire up this Apollo thing and maybe I have to do some, I either have to fake the server or get a real server and all that stuff. There's a price tag on that. And the value for that price tag is, I think that what you're saying is that I have to have a sufficiently complicated, complex model with enough relationships to make it worth looking at in this way. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. That's definitely a fair statement if you're talking about building your own server or not. I think that there are services out there for CMSs, for databases. So you've mentioned Hasura. There are lots of others. Services like Prismic or Sanity that have GraphQLs as well, and GraphQL endpoints as well. And at that point, it might not be that big of a deal to adopt GraphQL in order to interact with that kind of data or consume it, because again, they're doing all the heavy lifting. You're not having to implement it. They're worrying about caching and performance. You're not having to worry about that. And at that point, the benefit, I'm not sure they even offer REST APIs, but even if they did, at that point, the benefit is already your. It's not hard to write GraphQL. It brings a lot of simplicity and a lot of developer pleasure when it comes to consuming.
So you're seeing
pleasure
a lot of
public and simplicity. Yeah.
Oh yes. Sorry. So you're seeing more and more sort of public API, public services, data services, offer a GraphQL server in front of them so that it makes it easy for people to consume.
Absolutely. So one of the great things about GraphQL is that there's such a community of support and such an ecosystem of apps and plugins and so on that means that you are able to consume it in a type-safe way, for example. That means you're able to write it in a developer-friendly way, so you're not making mistakes, so that everything is checked, is linted, is and even at compile time, you're able to check with the server, does this match? Is this a valid query? That's nice. Huge. Which you can't do if you're just doing a fetch request in the browser to a REST API. You're assuming that it's going to give you back what you're looking for. Right. If you're in TypeScript, you might even assign a type to it. Oh, response is going to be of type endpoint response. But you have just made up the properties of the object that you're getting back, and they might be correct as of the time of writing, or you might be like me and make mistakes occasionally, and you're not going to be able to solve that.
It comes with metadata, which no API really does. Even with Swagger, that's not really giving you a type safe one. So and you've got standardization here. Like Mongo has its own query language, and everything has its own, but they feel proprietary. But what it sounds like, a lot of people are coalescing around the kind of metadata that comes from a graph that's specified by GraphQL and the query language that's specified GraphQL. And the more people get on board with that, the more we can interact with these different data sources in a consistent way. It's kind of your vision.
Absolutely. I think it is. I think that is a huge benefit. I mean, there are costs. So one of my personal bugbears is the fact that you can't. It's the flip side of the fact that that you request the shape of the object you want. You can't really control what it looks like. That's shaped by the server. So if I want to access the user's company's location's state, then I'm going to have an object nested four levels deep by the time I get the thing that I want. And I can't change that. I can't say, please give me just the string. I just want the string. I don't want object of an object of an object of an object.
You can't project it to flatten out?
Well, Ward.
That's what we used to do.
I don't think you can. I think you
have. No, I mean, in GraphQL, you may not be able to. In OData and all these other things, you could write a projection. But that's, although what you do is you lose object reference that way. As soon as you flatten things out again, then you have no, but anyway, now we're getting like down the rabbit hole. This will be wonderful for us to explore ourselves.
This would be, we've got a server. We've talked about the client, we've talked about the server, but this is in-between world.
Yeah.
The Jamstack has really come through as a popular preference. And let's throw out all the cool terms. Instead, let's say I'm a client-side front-end developer and I build stuff with GraphQL, but I don't have control over a server, but I do have access to AWS Lambda or Azure Functions or something that lets me build a serverless architecture. How do I use GraphQL with a serverless function so I don't have to go stand up a full-blown server?
So are you talking about using a serverless function as effectively the GraphQL server, or are you talking about the serverless function consuming a GraphQL endpoint that's somewhere else?
The former. So I want to use that as the server.
Serverless functions, I think, work well for REST APIs, and I think they work well for GraphQL APIs because, but in a sense, the so a GraphQL API is a set of functions. So we're talking about these resolver functions, and they transform the query or the mutation into actions or data that you're going to get back. And I guess the only disadvantage of doing that with a serverless API is that you only have one endpoint, so you can't take advantage of code splitting quite so easily as you would if you had a series of endpoints for a REST API where you can actually say the user's endpoint doesn't need to load any of the kind of code that deals with companies. You know, it just needs to
worry. Couldn't we just create separate serverless function endpoints for each one of those, just like we would in a Node Express server, for example? And I don't know, so I'm truly asking.
So typically, I think what people will do with the GraphQL endpoints is that you just have the one for a given version of the API. Mm-hmm. So and you create more as you create different versions of the API, which means that there's this contract between the server and the consumer that nothing's going to change. You can consume that and ask for the same kind of shape of object, and you will always get that, no matter what development has gone on the back end, no matter the shape of the database. And you just move up to the next version of the API when you're next ready to upgrade your app. And then you might have a slightly different set of things or a slightly different set of capabilities. But I think that means that you are always going to have to have a single gateway. A single Lambda has to handle that first endpoint.
It would be so huge. It has metadata. It has all this interpretive capabilities. This would be a lot of which you would want to cache. It would seem to me, John, I'm curious. I mean, was this where your question is coming from? Because this seems to me like the anti Lambda. This is a server that, you know, is going to be there. It's going to stand up. It's going to be around for a while. It's not something you flash into existence and out.
I'm challenging the idea that was said early on in this podcast of, well, the reason you use GraphQL is sometimes you don't have control over the back end. So therefore you use the GraphQL client to do what you're going to do, but you still need to set up a server. So the server is back end, which means I do have to have control over that. What if I don't have control over it actually setting up a real server? Could I use serverless? Because serverless is on servers. So what's the difference between standing up a server with Node Express or ASP.NET with GraphQL, whatever, versus having a serverless functions? I'm trying to understand the difference for folks.
So I think for me, the idea of not having control of a server I think that was undoubtedly something to lay at my feet. The benefit from my point of view is that if I have control of a server, I can change the shape of whatever comes back to me on the server. But if I don't have control of it, I can't do that. If I don't have control of a server, I can't change it to GraphQL without implementing my own server, which is a pain, depending on the size of database. And I realize that's what you're asking about. I wouldn't advocate creating a GraphQL sort of translator simply because you don't have control of the endpoint. Although you certainly could, but it's going to be a bit of extra work. But where I definitely see the benefit is if you're consuming somebody else's GraphQL server that you don't have control of, because at that point you're able to get the kind of customization of the data that you're receiving that normally you would have to have control of the server to get. So because you can specify just the relationships you're interested in and just the properties that you want to know, and you're not overwhelming your client's bandwidth. And in fact, things are a lot better because you're getting all back maybe in one object rather than in 10 different requests. And you're not then having to normalize it when it comes down to the wire to you. So, but I wouldn't necessarily create a server just in order to consume some REST APIs. Although, I mean, you certainly can. One tool I would recommend that we've used is Lighthouse PHP, which basically turns a Laravel install into a GraphQL server, or creates a GraphQL endpoint. So someone who has previously been working with, I realize it's quite specific, there are lots of other backend technology, including Node.js. But if you are using something else like PHP, Lighthouse is a great way of turning it into GraphQL in a sort of pretty much one step mechanism.
What led you to this, and why is this a good technology for you, Daniel?
The moment you have data coming in that's not what you expect, you have, I was suggesting earlier, you have start getting errors, and they're maybe unexpected and hard to debug. So we've been through a couple of different rounds of trying to solve that. One approach, which I think if that's the reason you're looking into GraphQL, that's maybe worth investigating, is using a great little library called IOTS, which allows you to do runtime type checking. You define the interface that you're looking to have, and then you can simply validate any data against that. And you have strong type-safe assurance at the other end. So you can just write your declaration using sort of a chained series of function calls, and then you can use the resulting validator function to guarantee type safety. It's really cool. But for us, the problem was that it added a little bit to our bundle size, not too much, but enough that I was wanting to cut it out. And again, it was moving things into the client that I would rather be in the server. So if I can just specify what I want to receive and have the server ensure that for me, then I feel that that answers all of my problems in a much simpler way. But IOTS is a great tool, and I would recommend it.
All right, Daniel, thank you so much for coming back onto the show and talking about this with us. We've dropped in a ton of notes in here between GitHub and documentation and a bunch of products that we were kind of tossing around. So thank you for all those links in there. And we'd like to end our show with a final thought for our listeners. This could be on topic or it could be off topic, such as maybe the coolest room I've seen so far in our video chats. I think Daniel owns that right now.
He owns
Unfortunately,
it.
Yeah, can't he all wins. See it. But he looks like he's coming out of like one of those old Christmas movies or Wilford Brimley sitting back
really
in his
does.
Chair.
He's actually talking to us from a closet, but he looks like he's...
Either that's a great green screen.
The fire there, Daniel. If we got the fire going, that'd be perfect.
Yeah, put the fire going in there. And there's an alabaster bust of somebody. You're an ancestor of yours, probably from the 16th century, no doubt.
Yeah, that's a really cool room, though.
All right, so let's go around the table. And Dan, what is your final thought for our listeners?
Well, you know, in thinking through all of this, I had another final thought, but I'm gonna change my final thought to a new final thought.
What is your final thought?
My final thought, I think I'm final on this, is it really makes you think through, and you know, John and Ward know I like to say this a lot, but that whole right tool for the right job scenario. Because I think a lot of us have learned about, for instance, RESTful services, and I've used them pretty extensively, you know, over the last whatever years, and they work great. But Daniel, you addressed a lot of points, which I've also run into, where that can be super problematic. And, you know, whether it's you don't own the server or you're doing a ton of cross service calls, you know, a lot of chatty type calls that really slow things down. I think this is a good opportunity for people that maybe haven't done this, though, to really kind of at least put a prototype together and say, hey, is this the right tool for our scenario? Now, Daniel, for yours, it was. I mean, that's obviously why we're talking. And you talked through some good scenarios, especially on some of the schema validation and things. So that'd be kind of my final thought is I think we kind of come up in technology sometimes with that there's one right way, because that's just what we learned. And of course, there's always many options. So this would be definitely one to consider.
It's a good lesson for everybody, Dan. Thanks. Final thought, Ward Bell.
I'm incapable of a final thought today. My brain is a blank. Well, it's totally blank. Part of it is that it's blanked by the fact that I have lived in this space that Daniel's describing for decades now, and it just feels like I know every tar pit you can go into. And yet the promise is there. And so I guess I'm coming back to the same thing that you're saying there, Dan, which I'm not sure we've done as much as we can to help people understand when this kind of tool really shines. But it's definitely worth exploring because it does shine. And I guess that's my thought.
Cool. And Daniel, what's your final thought for our listeners?
Well, it's occurred to me that there is that I think I've discovered the best social distancing sport for this lockdown generation, and I'm willing to be persuaded otherwise. But I think kayaking has a pretty good good set of requirements. So you have this paddle which you can use.
Daniel, I was with you. I was with you, and when you said right up until you said kayaking. The right answer there was being on a podcast with Dan and John and Ward. That was the answer to the best. But
while kayaking.
While kayaking. There you go. All right, buddy. Kayaking. So you've taken up kayaking and you recommend it?
Absolutely. I got a couple of dirt cheap kayaks, really beaten up and battered. And you know, I don't have to be precious about them, but it is nice to get out in the sunshine and get a bit of fresh air.
I was literally just this weekend, my brother got some kayaks. And so he's like, next time you come up, we got to go out to the lake. I haven't done it much. You done it once before, John?
Oh, kayaking. I have kayak failing stories just that go on. You can have so much fun. But yeah. I owned one once also, but somebody relieved me of it by stealing it from under the deck, and that's okay with me.
You look very beaten right now, Ward.
No, I loved it. I loved it. And oh, what a great thing to do with your wife if you haven't experienced an argument like you will when you've taken your wife kayaking.
You both can't leave. You know, I've never been kayaking, but back in college, I actually was into crew for a bit, and
really?
That was, I didn't know that.
So much fun. Eventually, I had to quit though because I was playing soccer and crew, and soccer was 6 hours a day at the time, and crew was getting up at 4:30 in the morning to get out to the river. And
you're losing too many balls into the river is what you're saying? You're trying to practice while your crew
This was all in Florida. So it's 90 something degrees out. I'm playing soccer 90 degrees. I'm out in the river 90 degrees. And at some point I had to rehydrate. So eventually I had to give up one, and it turned out to be crew. But I did indeed love being out on the water.
Where are you going with your kayak, Daniel?
I live in the middle of the countryside here in England, and I live on a river. So I don't have far to go, but I will say it's a very, very placid river. So there's not a lot of rapids going on, but somehow when you're on the water, it feels like you're, it's so peaceful. The world is so much lighter. The water reflects the sky back at you, and you feel, I think really very, very special. I've really enjoyed it.
Sounds delicious.
Sounds fantastic. Yeah. And my final thought, everybody, is that try GraphQL. It's actually really cool. And we push back in a lot of areas because, like every topic we talk about, you want to make sure you know what you're getting in for. And I'm glad we also talked about when you wouldn't be using GraphQL as well, because I've yet to find a technology that works in 100% of every situation for every person everywhere. So always be wary of anybody who says it works everywhere, no matter what you do. So give it a shot, see how it works for you, and send us some feedback. And if you have any other topics you want to hear about, please reach out to us on Twitter at RealTalkJS on Twitter. And thank you once again, everybody, for joining us. You'll hear from us every week on Real Talk JavaScript. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. follow and send them a message on Twitter at RealTalkJS.